Well, first of all, this question of what is socialism is a very large subject, and but nevertheless quite an appropriate subject, because we are meeting at a time of quite a deep crisis in capitalism. Many have explained it's probably the deepest crisis since the 1930s, and that has meant not only return of mass unemployment in all the major capitalist countries, but also austerity, vicious attacks on usually the most weakest and most vulnerable people in society. We'll hear tomorrow now after the budget how things are going to line up in Britain. But they're talking about attacks on the level of probably the 1920s and the Geddes Report. So it's we're in for a tough time. We see on a few days ago the movements in France, where millions of workers have taken to the streets. Also the case in Italy, where you've had the same movement. I think sooner or later in Britain also, workers and young people will have to move in order to protest against these big changes that are coming. And nothing that we've experienced in our lifetime has been on such a scale. But well, the idea of what is socialism, well, you can say firstly that it's the opposite of capitalism. It's the antithesis of capitalism, insofar as it's a society based on human need, human solidarity, as opposed to competition and greed. I don't want to disappoint anybody here, but it is not possible, I would say, to give an absolute blueprint of what socialism is, because such a blueprint does not exist. Unfortunately, I haven't brought the crystal ball along with me, so I can't work out in detail how I think. I can tell you what my beliefs are. But nevertheless, you can certainly have an idea of what the main features, I would say, of such a society will be, and the basis of such a society, which gives you at least a flavour and an idea of what we're aiming towards. You could say that this idea of socialism, or in a very vague way, is an idea that's a very, very old idea, insofar as over generations and generations and generations, particularly amongst those oppressed in society, there's always a deep wish and desire and dream of a better society, that surely something must be, an alternative must be there, where we as ordinary people can benefit from the riches and the fruits of the earth, as it were. After all, we're all alike. We're all put here on this planet for a short period of time. Surely we should be able to have a society based on the principles where everybody gains, rather than a certain minority gains at the expense of the majority. And this kind of idea, as I said, has been known for, you could say, at least 2,000 years, perhaps longer, insofar as even you can find it even being traced in the Christian movement of 2,000 years ago, insofar as that movement was first of all a revolutionary rebellion against the domination of the Romans. And it's been said, and I probably go along with it, that the figure of Christ was a revolutionary figure, even a communist figure. And I say this not because I'm a socialist, but because even if you look at the Bible, although the Bible is supposed to be written 2,000 years ago, we know that it went through many revisions as Christianity became more a state religion. And therefore, and the more it moved away from its roots, its revolutionary roots, it obviously was covered up. But even within the Bible, you have these phrases that that the meek will inherit the earth, that the woe unto those who are rich, that those who are first will be last, and those who are last will be first. In other words, a revolution in society. And above all, the quote that it's more difficult for a rich man to pass through the gates of heaven than for a camel to pass through an eye of the needle. I've never seen a camel or needle up front, but nevertheless, obviously a very difficult exercise, if not impossible. In other words, the very roots of this movement was for the poor, a revolutionary movement. And that those ideas, again, as I said, are not new, but are of a long, long history. That was, the breakup of the slave society and the emergence of revolutionary ideas. And you also see it appear at different stages in the disintegration or crisis in old societies. In the feudalism, for instance, in the 14th century, you had peasant uprisings in Britain and on the continent. And many of these peasant leaders had very much socialistic or communistic views. In Britain, there was a man called John Ball, who led the peasant uprising, not so far from here, as a matter of fact. And he had this famous phrase, which came down in history, if Adam delved and Eve span, who was then the gentleman? What is, in other words, the time of Adam and Eve, where was the kings, where was the nobles? There wasn't any. And he was trying to say, with that the case and this paradise that we had originally, why can't we have it today? And in these movements, there is a real thirst for another paradise, in a sense, a real paradise on earth, as opposed to when you die. But these were dreams, if you want to put it that way. These were just ideas that people fought for and died for. And you can actually see how they develop over the ages. Not just from the peasant revolts of the 14th century and the Lollards. They also had in the breakup of feudalism and the English Civil War, you have the development of the levellers movement and the diggers movement, which were primitive communist type movements. Or in the French Revolution, you have the sans-culottes. In Britain, you have the Chartist movement in the 19th century. And you have the ideas of Robert Owen, for instance, probably one of the greatest English socialists, who, although he was a manufacturer, he believed that society should be reorganised and that it should be run for the interests of ordinary people as opposed to a ruling elite. And these ideas were described as a kind of utopian socialism, insofar as they were nice, they were great ideas, wonderful visions. Yes, why can't we have a society based on happiness? Why can't it be based on equality? Why can't we do away with violence and war and misery and live in a cooperative way for the benefit of all? This was the idea, an ideal, if you like. And probably Robert Owen reflects, I would say, probably the pinnacle, if you like, the height of this kind of tradition that lasted over these generations. But then you have the movement then of the development of these ideas, in the ideas of Marxism and Marx and Engels, who gave these ideas a qualitative difference, insofar as rather than just being good ideas, and I think they're wonderful ideas, insofar as a society based on these values would be tremendous. But rather than just ideas, how could they be put into practice? How could they become reality? And this is where Marx and Engels begin to link up the ideas of socialism, a new form of society based on these values, which arises from history itself. It's not just simply a good idea that you could have had 2,000 years ago, but this idea of socialism now becomes a very material thing insofar as it arises out of the development of history and society itself. And out of capitalism will emerge a newer, higher stage of society called socialism. And Marx and Engels put it in a context of the history in a context, actually, that for the vast bulk of human society, there wasn't any private property. There weren't any classes. And that was a period we called primitive communism. That broke up. And you had the emergence of private property with the emergence, really, of society's ability to produce a surplus. That surplus, above the day-to-day means to keep yourself alive, allowed a ruling class to come into being, insofar as if people were forced to work and could produce a surplus, and that surplus could be taken by people, a minority, then they would not have to work themselves. They could live off the produce produced by the mass. And that, although it's exploitation, it is sorrowful, it is heart-rending, but nevertheless, from the point of view of history, it's a bit of a leap forward, insofar as it allows a minority, although a privileged elite, allows them time. And that allows people to develop ideas and culture and science and technique, and allows for, and therefore, the beginnings of civilization begins to occur on the basis of this, of class society coming into being. And Marx said that class society, although you have the evils of class society, you can also say that this is the, through class society, paradoxically, you will get to the emancipation and the end of all classes. And this is a very kind of, wow, revolutionary kind of concept, never been considered before. This idea of a new society and socialism and superabundance and so on were just good ideas. For Marx now and Engels, this idea of Marxism said, no, it's not just good ideas, it can be actually brought into reality, which before it could not have been brought into reality, because the level of technique, the level of science, the level of productive technique was so low that you could not produce a superabundance of things. You couldn't guarantee everybody a reasonable living standard. It was not possible. Again, people starved because of famine, because of the weather, and so on, except like today. And harvest was ruined, and so on and so forth. And everybody was at the very mercy of nature. So you live into hand to mouth, and there was no real. It was a very primitive basis of society. Whereas the big change came with the actual development of capitalism. Capitalism, although we can say today, well, capitalism is very bad. Yeah, look at wars, look at this, the unemployment and so on. As a system, if you read the Communist Manifesto by Marx and Engels, he says, hang on a minute, this capitalist system was in its youth, if you like, quite a revolutionary system of society, insofar as it developed the productive forces to much greater extent than any other period in history before. And the Communist Manifesto, it says, look at it, it's conquered the world, it's created a world market, it's exported capitalism everywhere, and has created the material possibilities for a society, a new society, if it's based on those possibilities of superabundance. And therefore he said, look, that's the role of capitalism, that class society is has allowed mankind, allowed human beings to build up the possibility for their own emancipation and for the abolition of classes in society. And this was quite a revolutionary thing. Only problem is, says Marx, well, not a problem, but capitalism is not a smooth-running form of society. Capitalism, on the contrary, is a very contradictory society, insofar as it's based upon the mass of the population, the working class, you want to put it that way, which originally in a bygone age probably had access to its own limited means of production, the land and petty crafts and so on. All that was taken off them. like well, we know from our own experience, not experience, but our own history in Britain, the enclosure movements, which basically enclosed all land of the peasants and so on, into the land of on a concentrated land ownership, if you like, into the hands of large-scale landowners, and that the means of production were slowly built up through primitive accumulation, robbery, stealing, you name it. A minority of the population, the capitalists, began to gather in a monopoly of the means of production. So you have capitalism based upon the exploitation of the working class by the capitalists. The workers, like the slaves, like the serfs before them, did all the work, and the ruling class, you know, took the surplus that they produced. But the revolutionary thing about capitalism is that the capitalists reinvested this surplus in building up through competition. They had to beat the competition, they had to steal the market and so on. And they could only do this by investing and building up new machines, labour-saving devices, increasing the productivity of labour. So with that, the means of production developed. But of course it meant enormous wealth at one end and working class people at the other end. Until today, for instance, you have this competition has resulted in monopolies, these huge giant firms, you know, like ICI and Toyota and Ford's and goodness knows what, all these huge Walmart, doesn't remember Walmart, all these huge companies now which dominate the entire globe. And you have the concentration of wealth is so great, it's unbelievable. Not even Karl Marx would have thought about it. And I saw a fact the other day that, 225 people have the wealth of $50 billion, which is equivalent to 7% of the world's population, which translated into numbers is 400 million people. So 225 people have got the wealth equivalent to 400 billion. This is the extremes of wealth, isn't it? On a world scale. We all know the figures about a billion people living on a $1 a day, and another billion and a half living on $1 to $2 a day. And the fact that 10 million children under the age of 5 die every year because of malnutrition and disease, which can be cured, but they die because of want. So you have the squalor on the one hand, and you have the super riches on the other hand. I mean, when you talk about this $1 a day business, it's incredible. You can have a senior executive would earn in 1 hour more than these people have learned to earn in a year, or live on in a year. I mean, how obscene can you get? So this is how crazy things have got. You've got unemployment, because the problem with under capitalism is that it's a society based upon profit and profit motive, and therefore everything is done for profit and gain. Doesn't matter what the social consequences are. Doesn't matter. That is the profit motive, and with that you have the position whereby workers were in work were now displaced because labour-saving machinery is brought in, new technique is brought in, and they are on the dole. And you think this is a topsy-turvy world insofar as, well, surely the idea of a machine or labour-saving device is to lighten the burden of work, to make it easier to work, rather than to kick people out, and the people who are left in work have to work longer, harder hours. And this is the kind of logic of capitalism. It's not their fault, I suppose. It's just this is the system we live under. And as a result, you have mass unemployment, and you have overproduction. Now, the reason why I paused there, because think about it. Under feudalism, people went starving because there wasn't enough. There was a scarcity. There wasn't enough food, there wasn't enough things. And that produced a crisis. Today, you have the opposite. You have a crisis of overproduction. In other words, we've gone so insane, not we, because I don't include myself in this, but capitalism is so insane that it now has built up so much productive potential, it's producing too many things that the market cannot absorb at the profit. And this is not me, obviously all the capitalist economists talk about this. I think I've got a quote here from the Daily Telegraph, not exactly my paper, but there we are, of some months ago. Too many steel mills have been built. Too many plants making cars, computer chips, solar panels, too many ships, too many houses. They have outstripped the spending power of those supposed to buy the products. And it goes on and on and on and on. All I'm getting is, how crazy. This is the nature of capitalism, that periodically we have overproduction. In other words, when there's so many people need things, I mean, old age pensioners, elderly people die every year in Britain because of the cold. I mean, there are 5 million people on the waiting list in Britain for a house. There are 14 million on or below the poverty line in Britain at the present time. There are so many things we need to do, and yet we're stopping people working. Factories are shut down, production lines are mothballed, and people are told, sorry mate, you can't work here because we got too much. And yet there's so many things needed to be done. And that's the illogic, if you like, of capitalism. And the reason why I say these things is because of the opposite that we're talking about in relation to socialism. But socialism is not based on private profit. It's based on the needs of people. And the way this can only be overcome, this be solved, if you want to solve it, is that the factories, the banks, the resources held by the small, perhaps 5% of the population, perhaps less, 1, 2, 3% of the population own everything, that has to be taken out of their hands and put in the hands of the people. That's the whole point. That the only way this could be solved is that society must be run in the interests of working people itself. Not for private profit, but for people's need. Pretty idea, need. If we need something, why don't we produce it? That is surely the best method of actually running a society rationally. So, and because under capitalism, you've got everything. You've got the advertising, pollution, you name it under capitalism, all because of the profit motive, which can be eliminated on the basis of eliminating the profit motive and preparing things for, planning things for need. Because at the end of the day, if we have these resources, and I'll just come back to it. Capitalism was run for competition. They always say that. We're all competitive. And that. But hang on a sec. Inside the capitalist firms, they don't compete. They plan. Take Walmart, for instance, my favourite. Right? I think it's 1.9 million people work for Walmart. It's international. ASDA. But they are very centrally planned. You know, they know exactly what is being sold in the shops, how much is being sold, because all, when you go to the supermarket, they've got these barcodes, it goes thick, and that then registers in the place how many has been sold, what needs to be supplied. It's all figured down to the last bottle of water, probably, and they do this through central planning. Same way, like a car company, Toyota. Toyota has 60 different makes of car. It has 65 different companies in 28 countries. But Toyota runs what you call a just-in-time program, which means they have to know exactly how many component parts are needed, because they don't stock too many of them, and they immediately rush these component parts. In other words, it's dictated to centrally, planned out centrally, because that is the most efficient and effective way of doing it. They don't go into competition with Toyota down the road, or the body plant up the road, or the wheel arches down the road over here. They combine it and plan it. It sounds pretty obvious, but all I'm saying is they always talk about competition, 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 when in reality they do not have competition within their plants and their industries. But as soon as they leave the gates, then they go to this market, they don't even know what it is. They just, one section produces some produces something else, another produces, and suddenly you've got overproduction. They do not know what the limits of the market really is. They have tried to do it to estimate what the limits are sometimes, and what they tend to do is cut back. So they, what they call is excess capacity we've got. In other words, we have, instead of a firm with 100 machines actively producing goods with workers obviously employed in them, they only produce about 50 machines. Now the rest of the 50 machines lies idle. It's excess capacity. It is not used. In other words, it is squandered. Because at the end of the day, if you do not produce these things, they will deteriorate. Obviously, you know, it's factories deteriorate, machines deteriorate, raw materials deteriorate, things deteriorate if you just leave them. And if you can't sell them, that's exactly what happens. Under the capitalism, you have this madness of overproduction. They cannot sell the goods. But under socialism, we will plan it. We will say, hang on a minute, we've got computers after all. Surely, you know, on the basis of the technology we have, we can actually understand what the needs are. We have to have the participation of the population. They run society. Not an elite, not myself, to telling you, by the way, today we're going to have so many things printed or so many things done. The people have to. Socialism is about the empowering the people, if you want to put it, empowering working people, for them to have ownership and control over their lives. And obviously, control of their lives means control over their employment, or their jobs, our production, and what needs to be produced. And the reason for this is very important, because we have had instances where. It's probably a topic for another discussion in one sense, the Russian Revolution, right? In Russia in 1917, the Bolshevik Party came to power, led the working class, overthrew capitalism, did away with landlordism, did away with the capitalists, and power was in the hands of the working class through organizations they established themselves. They're called Soviets, or Russian name for Workers' Council. So production and the running society was in the hands of workers' committees, workers' councils, Soviets in the first instance. The only problem was they were attacked by 21 foreign armies from every country in the world trying to crush the Russian Revolution. There was civil war, there was famine, there was cholera, there was typhoid, and above all, there was even cannibalism in 1920. The whole thing had been brought down to a state of, because the capitalists internationally wanted to crush this revolution. And the Bolsheviks didn't think you could have socialism in Russia, in one back, although it was 1/6 of the world surface, still a very, very backward country, feudal dominated country, agricultural. After all, didn't Karl Marx say that the emancipation of the working class is the task of the working class itself, because the working class is the real revolutionary force in society, and the revolution will occur probably in Britain, Germany, France, the industrial main countries are not. But God, Russia, backward old Russia. No, no, no. That was too backward. It'd be the advanced countries where capitalism was the most advanced. Why? Because socialism cannot be based upon a primitive accumulation, a primitive basis. It has to be based upon the highest that capitalism itself can produce. Because it's a higher form than capitalism. Get off my needles a minute. It's a higher form than capitalism, isn't it? Whereas in Russia, what happened in Russia? Well, the Bolsheviks said this was not going to be socialism in one country. It was the beginning of the world revolution, and that we'd have to spread the revolution to Germany, France, etc., etc., the world, and thereby they will help us. We haven't got the technique, but the workers in other countries can help us with the technique. Great idea. Unfortunately, the revolutions were betrayed in other countries, and the revolution became distorted, completely distorted and twisted, and you had the rise of Stalinism, a dictatorship in Russia. And although they nationalized the economy, they didn't have workers' control, they did not have workers' democracy, which is essential, because without workers' democracy, you cannot plan properly society. You have bureaucrats controlling society. And that's not socialism whatsoever. It must be the working class itself control society and works out exactly at the plan of production, etc., etc. That requires democracy, and that's what the Bolsheviks wanted. They wanted democracy, but as they were attacked and overthrown, but then you had Stalinism, workers' democracy was eliminated, and that's why you had the fall, the collapse, really, of Stalinism, these regimes, because you cannot have a nationalized economy working without workers' democracy. There's no way it can be done. Otherwise, it will all seize up and collapse, which is exactly what happened. So what you have there is a bit of an idea that we have to take over the commanding heights of the economy. The working class has to have control and democracy. Democracy is an essential ingredient to socialism. It's not an add-on. It's because we have to discuss, we have to debate, we have to criticize, and we have to participate in the discussion to see how we want things done, how things are going to be built, how things are going to be constructed. We have to have the involvement of the people of working people. Now, some people think, working class people, they don't know nothing. They're uneducated, you know, they're ignorant. You know, what do they know, and so on and so forth. That's an idea that comes from the elite, of course, because they don't understand that working class people have potential to learn. And that's the whole point. If you kept down, if you have to work, you know, 8, 9, 10, 12 hours a day, and you're physically exhausted, how can you do anything? Most people, after that, they go home and turn the television on, or go down to the pub, just to escape this misery of ongoing week. Because the idea that somehow workers can become capitalists is a nonsense. As if, I'll save up, after the end of the week, I'll put my money aside and I'll become a capitalist. Most of the rich people in Britain never got rich by that. They got rich through inheritance. They inherited their wealth. That's where it comes from in reality. So what we are saying is that working class people have enormous potential, and they have enormous abilities if they're given a chance to shine, to participate. And so, and that requires time. Because if you're working God knows how long hours, you're not in a state to get involved. So the key thing is, if we want working people to participate in the running of society, in the running of industry, of technique, or whatever you want, which I believe is the essential ingredient for socialism, then you have to lower drastically the hours of work to give them the time, the free time, in order to participate in the running of society, to raise their cultural level, to participate in education, of culture, and so on and so forth. And that's what we'd have to do. But why is it possible? Yes, it's possible. Why? Because we have this enormous build-up under capitalism of enormous sophisticated machinery, of automated machinery, of science, of technique, that if it was put to the use in a productive way for people's needs, we could, instead of throwing people 3, 4, 5 million on the dole, everybody gets a job, everybody has work, but everybody then has a lower amount of hours worked. In other words, the amount of hours come tumbling down. You could work, why not, 6 hours a day, maybe 5 hours a day. As society progresses and increases its productive potential, the amount of hours you need to work will be less and less. So you have free time. When I talk about new society, I'm talking about happiness. Sounds like it's a great little word, like happiness. How do you have a feeling of fulfillment, of joy, of an ability to have relationships with people rather than not have relationships with people, insofar as we want human beings to live as human beings and not as animals. And I say that in the most respectful way, because this is a dog eat dog society we live in under capitalism. It's all about greed. And then you say, oh, it's what, human nature. Well, of course, if you've got scarcity, you do have a bit of greed. Some people want a bit more than others, you do it. But if you put people in a different environment where you've got a lot of things, you don't, and you can provide the needs of people, then you do not have this greed. Look at those miners who were trapped down in the mine in Chile. Oh, they survived. Not only survived, their well-being was, why? Because they were solidarity. They worked together, not against each other. In other words, in the most terrible situation, human solidarity wins out in the end. And that is probably the deepest instincts of human solidarity. But you've got to raise the living standards. You know, if you have a desert island and you've got one loaf of bread, you've got two people on it, they'll fight over the piece of that loaf of bread. But if you've got a desert island with two people and you've got loads of stuff on it, they're not going to fight each other, because you provide, because it's ludicrous, it's nonsense. In other words, it's the scarcities of capitalism which create the conflict, the jealousies and all the rest that emerge, does occur. But the way to eliminate that is obviously on the basis of raising the living standard of people. In other words, and how are you going to do that? You do it on the basis of production for need, and not in one country, but internationally. It does require, yes, dare I say it, an international revolution, because socialism can only be done on a world scale. But then you raise the entire living standards of the entire globe, rather than, at the moment, a tiny handful, like an idea of people, like one guy anyway. So pretty amazing. Well, because look at this. This is today, isn't it? Yeah. The FT, have you read the Financial Times? Nice little article today, look. Controls on currencies doomed, it says. The only way I illustrate this point is that the governments in certain countries are trying to protect their currencies. And they can't do it. Because the people who own the currency, these billionaires, are able to get round them. They're able to dictate the governments. They're able to knock governments aside and do what they like. In fact, it's not on page 4. One of the guys who does it. There's an interview with a man who's called Bill Gross, and he says, yeah, bond market sage reveals lessons from blackjack. I don't know if you know what blackjack is. It's gambling, you know, with cards, isn't it? He went to the casino and learned how to become a bond manager. He now has a portfolio, they call it, of $1,000 billion. Not a bad little sum, $1,000 billion. This one guy. So here's the power this guy has. He employs 1,300 people worldwide. And the power in this man's hands is phenomenal. He can destroy governments, just like George Soros. He came to Britain, by the way, doesn't it? And bet against the British pound and forced it off the European control, whatever it was, mechanism. And he got a huge stack of money for it. These people are spivs or speculators. They've had their day. And the capitalists are holding on. You know, we really are the future. And they want, and everybody's unemployed, desperate, you know, starving in the world and so on. And they are, no, we are the future. They say, it reminds me of, years ago, they used to have toll gates, didn't they, in Britain? You know, toll gate. But you can imagine a society where all the roads, and each road had its own toll gate. And the roads were paid for by the government, by the way, but never mind, there are toll gates everywhere. And every time a car drove up, the man used to rush out from the toll gate, collect his money, open the gate, and the car used to go through. And after the day was out, the man who did the toll gate was so tired. He put so much effort into this. He really, really worked hard. And he thought he was the best. He thought he was necessary, if you like. And the moral of the tale is that under a society based on these toll gate systems, think they are there for life. They think they are natural, when in fact the matter, all you want to do is get rid of the toll gates, get a free road, and they're not really necessary. In the same way, the capitalists are not really necessary. They're there as an imposition, because what they do anyway, they speculate, they don't work, and therefore they finish. And they therefore are a barrier to the development of human society itself. And all I say they should do is part company. They should move aside and allow working people to take control. And when I say take control, is there any kind of examples of this, apart from, I said, Russia? But there was an example which is worth quoting, the Paris Commune of 1871. And in the Paris Commune of 1871, there was a war going on between the French and the Germans. German armies invaded and nearly took Paris, and the French ruling class decided to move out, and the workers rose up and took power in Paris, and they organised themselves. And how did they do it? Well, yes, they elected people. Funny enough, it wasn't a dictatorship, they elected people. And not only did they elect people, they elected people with the right of recall. In other words, if someone was doing badly, out. You don't represent us, out. Immediately, no messing about. And also, they would be on the average wage of ordinary workers. So there wasn't any bureaucracy, wasn't any sort of elite. And the other thing they demanded was that everybody should have arms. There shouldn't be a separate state holding them down. So you had the election of officials, the right of recall, and none of them on a privileged basis. And what they all want to do is rotate as well. Areas of responsibility, so everybody had an opportunity to involve themselves in the running of society. What a great idea, as opposed to bureaucrats who are privileged and there for their entire lives and so on and so forth. So this is the kind of model that occurs in history, pointers if you want, because as I said, I do not have a crystal ball. I do not know exactly how socialism will work out in detail or whatever. It's not possible. And will there be problems? Of course there'll be problems. Will there be arguments? Of course there'll be arguments. But at least we can have rational arguments. At least we can have rational problems and we can discuss them out and solve them. Because every problem has a solution. And after all, 95% of all scientists who've ever lived on this planet are alive today. Amazing. But these scientists are usually employed by governments and companies, and they are either fighting one another, in competition with one another, or they guard their secrets against one another. What happened if they cooperated? Huh? What a fantastic opportunity where science would cooperate in the benefits of everybody, solving the problems of disease, of hunger, of all the other things. But of course, on a capitalist basis, it cannot be done. It's impossible, because the profit motive dominates and the interests of the capitalist class come first. So I say, you know, capitalism had its day. You can tell that outside. Millions unemployed, starving. It's going to get worse, by the way. We've had last 40-odd, 50-odd years have been a kind of good time for capitalism. It's kind of, from now on, it's way down because of the impasse it's reached on a world scale. Therefore, socialism is not some dream, but socialism, with the nice music in the background, is a possibility, can be an inevitability if we fight for it. Because, you know, we make history, we decide, it's not made for us, we can do it if we participate together and fight for that idea. Anyway, I'll leave it with that.